We're going to open the House Committee on Human Services on today, February 16, 2009. And today we're going to open up an informational meeting on mental health, substance abuse, and addiction. And Richard Harris, I think you are our first presenter. Do you want to bring up Karen Wheeler also? Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. How are you doing?
Good. How are you? Yes, we're happy back. Are we missing somebody who was ill? I know Representative.
No, probably here.
Howard is here.
I don't know about
Matt
her.
They're up with John.
I saw John this morning.
All right.
Oh, John's here.
John's
somewhere.
Here.
Okay. Good. Welcome.
And good morning.
Introduce yourselves, please.
Okay. Richard Harris, Interim Assistant Director, Department of Human Services for Addictions and Mental Health. Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. We're very pleased to have an opportunity this morning to give you an overview of the Addictions Division at AMH, and we have, I think, a great panel of people to talk about various aspects of our organization. And as a way of introduction, I think previous testimony here, I've told the committee that I've been in this system a long time as a provider, but only a short time in my current position at AMH. And one of my favorite topics is really about addictions. That's an area that I've been working in at Central City Concern over the past 30 years in providing a variety of treatment services for late-stage chronic alcoholics. The addiction system here in Oregon is an interesting system from the point of view is that the state provides no services directly. We work through our counties as partners and many nonprofits, providers in the various communities around the state who actually operate the system and many provide the services to many people. So that the delivery system really is exists in throughout the state of Oregon, and it has many names because many programs are operating delivering the services to people. We depend a lot on block grant from the federal government and Medicaid from the federal government, but by and large this is a general funded state general fund system, which is supplemented to some in some communities by counties who also put funds into the system. But in no way does the state of Oregon pay for the breadth of the services that are out there. All these nonprofit organizations are fundraising all the time and creating other options for funding the system of services in their community. And most of those services are unique to those communities. So it's a combination of the service elements that the state funds as well as the counties as well as the nonprofits that are providing services. These services include detox facilities, residential facilities, outpatient, intensive outpatient, with really a focus in many communities on families. One of the things I wanted to point out, Karen Wheeler here, the Addictions Program Administrator, will go through the presentation in much more detail. But just to focus for a moment on the system here that we have is quite unique in many respects. So we focus on families. There are a number of residential programs that serve parents, mostly single mothers with children, or pregnant when they come into treatment. So there's an effort to work with children and families to make sure that addicted moms have an opportunity to deliver drug-free babies. And that's going on around the state. Other things that are unique about this system is that we have moved over the past 7 or 8 years to a recovery-oriented system. In the old days, what we did, we assumed that people could deal with their addiction issues, send them to a 28-day treatment program someplace. They would come back to the community. They would be ready to resume their lives. We no longer believe that's the case. We understand that this is a disease that requires lifelong management and that our emphasis needs to be on preparing people to manage this problem over their lifetime, and that means more than just a 28-day treatment period. So how we do that is that we are investing in supportive housing. Supportive housing, there are over 2,000 units of alcohol and drug-free housing in the state of Oregon in various communities. There are over 170 Oregon recovery homes, most of them Oxford houses. They're currently housing about 1,300 individuals and 300 children living in these recovery homes. We also put an emphasis in the last few years on peer-based and mentor services as a way to help people engage in the treatment system and to develop long-term recovery plans. In fact, we just issued a letter to the community about certifying peer recovery service counselors, and we'll be in the process over the next 2 or 3 months to certify probably up to about 100 peer mentors around the state. I think that the addition of these supportive services, supportive housing, make Oregon unique. In fact, in many ways, Oregon is the model for this recovery-oriented treatment system. And another way Oregon is unique is that we have placed an emphasis on evidence-based practice, so that that over half of the practice of treatment services are delivered in evidence-based practice models, which is showing a great outcomes to those sorts of services. I know these services are effective. In the years I was operating and managing the Hooper Detox Center, which went started in I started there in 1982, there were about 3,000 people who came to the Detox Center in a year. Most of those, at least 2,800 of them, returned more than one time for detox services. So when I arrived there, we had what we all referred to as a revolving door. People had came in many times for the same thing, would be discharged back to the community, and would relapse and return. Over the years, as we instituted safe, sober housing in the community, and then later with peer mentor services, that recidivist rate, that revolving door, is down to less than 10% now. So we know that the services are effective if people have the right follow-up to stay sober over the long run, and that takes more than just the standard treatment elements. So those are some of the good news. Some of the bad news things, though, is that our system last year saw over 62,000 youth and adults in some form or another across the state. That's 25% of the need. The estimated prevalence of addiction, both to drugs and alcohol, is over 260,000 people in the state of Oregon who need publicly funded services. So we're only meeting about 25% of the need, and I think that is the biggest challenge for us and for you, is to figure out how we can do better at serving more people. I want to turn it over now to Karen Wheeler, who is the Addictions Program Administrator.
Thank you and good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Addictions Programs Administrator for the Addictions and Mental Health Division at DHS. I have a few points that I'd like to make before I start talking about the slides that you have. You have copies of a PowerPoint slide presentation. And thinking about this over the weekend, as I do typically over the weekend, I want to make sure that you understand and you know what I tell my neighbors and friends who approach me at various times throughout the year and want to know, what is addiction anyway? What does it look like? How does somebody get addicted? Isn't it their fault that they're addicted? I have these questions posed to me because I am active in my community, and I also associate with a lot of people who are in recovery. Addiction is a chronic health condition, and it requires, as Richard said, management across the lifespan. We have known for the past 200 years, before Oregon was even a state, that addiction was a chronic progressive disease. In journals of medicine that go back more than 200 years this has been talked about. But in the United States, this proclamation hasn't been understood or fully utilized as a foundation to build systems of care. Addiction continues to be treated in the United States, and also most countries who look at the United States as a model for health care, as if it were a bacterial infection, a broken bone, or a ruptured appendix. But we know that chronic illnesses span different human afflictions, such as asthma, hypertension, especially type 2 diabetes. These chronic illnesses have a lot in common with drug and alcohol addiction. They're all influenced by genetics and other personal, family, and environmental risk factors. They're influenced by behaviors that begin as voluntary choices but evolve in deeply ingrained patterns that, in the case of addiction anyway, are further exacerbated by changes in the brain. Literally, the neurobiology of the brain changes when people begin to use alcohol and drugs. They're also marked by profound disability, premature death, and disease. We talk about addiction treatment as being disease prevention, also infectious disease prevention. If we can get folks into treatment, stop the practice of sharing needles, we can prevent infectious diseases. This condition also generates psychological responses such as hopelessness, depression, low self-esteem, and anxiety. My notes got out of order, so hold on just one second. We also know that addiction is a treatable disease, it's a preventable disease, and that recovery is a reality for thousands of Oregonians. And today you'll hear people later on the panels talk about their own recovery, and really the treatment providers, the recovery support providers see recovery every single day. And being in this field myself for over 24 years now, some of the most rewarding experiences that I've had in my career are when people have come back to me 5 years later, 10 years later, and told me, you know what, I didn't get it at first. I came through your program. I also worked in a nonprofit private treatment program for 11 years in Eugene in Springfield, Oregon. But now I get it. I've gotten my kids back. I'm working. This is how much I make. People are very proud of the fact that they've gotten jobs, that they're now contributing to their communities. I've had people bring their pay stubs in to show me how much they're making and just be really, really proud of themselves. And that is one thing about being in this field. If I only saw the hopelessness and despair, perhaps if I would have been a police officer or if I would have chosen a profession in an emergency room, I wouldn't see this positive aspect of recovery. But I really am thankful every single day that I'm in this field. And now at the state, I just get to see more and more of it because we do have a recovery advisory committee. We meet with people in recovery on a monthly basis so that they can tell us what's happening out there for them and what they believe people need to really stay in recovery, engage in recovery. And we want to be informed by that voice as we set forth policies and practices at the state level. I would also echo what Richard said about addiction services being cost-effective. More than any other service that I've ever seen or studied, addiction services have a cost avoidance element, especially to criminal justice and juvenile justice systems, child welfare systems, and other social welfare systems. I was looking at a summary. There's a compilation of national cost offset studies that every single state is either doing or has done, and it's also in a PowerPoint presentation format. Looking through all of these studies, there's a return on investment anywhere from $4 to $7 for $1 spent on addiction services. And that's for the treatment cost offset studies. There's a $10 return on investment for prevention, substance abuse prevention services. And actually, Oregon was one of the first states to have ever conducted a cost offset study in 1996. Dr. Mike Finnegan did a study for us back when we were the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs before we merged with the Mental Health Division. And that study showed a $5.60 cost offset associated with addiction treatment.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Maurer.
Can you explain the difference between cost avoidance, cost offset, a cost containment? Because we hear those words a lot, and meaning is very important in how we're defining it, because, you know, those are huge savings, and it'd be helpful to know what we're hearing.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, members of the committee, I'm not a researcher, but I do know that in the case of the Oregon study that was done in 96 that I referenced, Dr. Finnegan used a cohort of treatment completers and used a matched comparison group. And the cost avoidance was associated with costs in Medicaid and other social services like child welfare, any service that would have been funded by the Department of Human Services. So that treatment cohort was compared against a matched cohort of people, of similar people, who were also on the Medicaid program.
Who did not receive treatment, is that what you're
Who did not receive treatment.
Follow-up?
Is that over a period of like 1 year? Or, you know, because you can cost avoidance can be in the future, and, you know, those are hard to report on. But if it's like a set period of time.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, the period of time was the folks who received treatment received that treatment between 1991 and 1992, and they were followed for 2.5 years following treatment.
So it sounds like you're asking for something that perhaps she isn't prepared today to give us exactly, but maybe we can ask for that information in the future.
It's actually not about the specific costs in the study, but what does it mean? Is it, you know, am I saying I'm going to save money, you know, 50 years in the future, or am I saving money today? Because of the conversation about funding these programs, if you can show me where I'm going to save money today or within a year, the conversation is a lot different about some nebulous, you know, horizon that's so far out that it's hard to judge.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer. What I've seen in the studies, and this has been a citation in some of the studies, is that treatment pays for itself on the day it's delivered. And what it means is it doesn't mean that the state takes away funding from these other programs, because obviously there's going to be people, whether they're addicted folks or other folks, who are going to need these services. But it means that there was an offset for those clients who did get treatment. They did not need those services in the future because they were in recovery or had gotten jobs or had gotten their children back and didn't need foster care for their children any longer.
So the offset would be that year? Is that what you're implying? Or within 5 years?
Chair Tomei, for this study, it was within 2.5 years that these people were followed. And the cohort group was also followed during that same time period.
Would you like something further? Would you like to get further information?
No, it's fine. I knew what the answer was going to be, but I was trying to, for the audience and for the panels, to explain this, because these are really important questions. And these money debates, unfortunately, really drive the policies that we implement. And so if we don't understand, if we're really not getting our bang for a buck, then let's don't do this stuff. But if it works, let's do it.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Van Orman, did you wish to add to that?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think for me, what I'm seeing is the case of, let's say, somebody who's in Head Start, and they've got a family of children. Some of them are 3 years old. Some of them are five. And the question to to me, the cost avoidance would be the fact that we've gotten this parent under treatment. We are working with the children at the same time. The children haven't been removed. They're not going through the court system. So that the avoidance of cost is primarily the fact that we're taking care of all of these issues before the parent becomes totally disabled and unable to handle this. Is that an accurate description?
Chair Tomei, Representative Van Orman. Yes, there are many cost avoidance or cost offset studies. Those terms are typically used interchangeably, although I have to say I'm not a researcher again. But there are prevention studies as well as treatment studies. So in the case of Head Start, or another one I'm familiar with is the Family Nurse Partnership, where you can visit with families right after they've had a baby, and you talk with them about how they're coping, if there's appropriate bonding and attachment and care for that child. Those have a significant bang for the buck. If you can stop any kind of trajectory for depression, maternal depression, substance use, even address smoking, nicotine, those are very, very cost-effective. And people have been talking a lot, I know in this building and elsewhere, about the Washington Institute for Public Policy in terms of the criminal justice studies that are out there. The Washington Institute also produces reports about prevention and treatment studies that are not only related to criminal justice outcomes and the cost offsets for those kind of practices. And at home, I have a stack literally probably this big of Washington Institute reports, in addition to the one on the criminal justice practices that everybody's talking about, on prevention practices specifically, and the cost avoidance for those practices. And they are definitely worth the bang for the buck.
Great. Karen, I know we've got a lot of people here wanting to speak, so we're going to move on.
So in wrapping up, I would just say that addiction is well-grounded in research. Treatment is well-grounded in research. We lead the nation in Oregon for implementing evidence-based practices in treatment and prevention. I'm asked to speak in other states all the time because they're watching what we're doing. And I would have to just echo that there's a large gap between the estimated need and how many people we're able to serve in Oregon. And now to go through briefly some of the slides, just to hit on some of the major...
If you give the page numbers as you refer to them.
Yes. If you look at slide number 3, I'll skip over how this system is organized because Richard covered that, and you can see that in slide number 2. But in slide number 3, you'll see that this is the prevalence information for Oregon's alcohol and drug abuse prevalence. Overall, it's about 8.3%. This information comes from a survey that's done every year. It's called the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, and it's funded by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration at the federal government. We believe that it underestimates somewhat because this is a telephone survey. They call thousands of people throughout the country and ask them a variety of questions about their alcohol and drug use. So people who are living in institutions or in shelters do not get a phone call. And those people tend to have more problems with alcohol and drug abuse. So we see that this is somewhat underestimated. So we talk about 1 in 10 people being affected by alcohol and drug abuse. And if you think about one person being affected by alcohol and drug abuse, they typically impact another 7 people in their lives. So this illness impacts a lot of people in communities throughout the state. The one figure that I would like you to target here is the 20.1 prevalence rate for young adults. So for young adults between the ages of 18 and 25, the prevalence rate for abuse and dependence is 20%. So that's a real population that we want to be focusing on. Those are folks that are in their prime years to get jobs, to go to college, to have children, and we want to make sure that they're the healthiest that they can possibly be. On the next slide, page 4, you may have heard about a study that was done last year by Eco Northwest. This study demonstrated that just in 1 year alone, in 2006 in Oregon, there was a $5.9 billion cost to substance abuse in Oregon, untreated substance abuse. And most of that is related to lost earnings and lost productivity in the workforce. So $4.15 billion of that is lost productivity. And $813 million is health care costs. And then another $967 million is attributed to law enforcement, criminal justice, and social welfare costs, child welfare and self-sufficiency. On the next slide, you'll see the Institute of Medicine model for addiction services. This is basically the framework that we use to talk about our addiction services in Oregon. So we want to have a balanced system where we have prevention, treatment, and recovery maintenance or recovery support services. As we mentioned earlier, and I'll just say again, this is a chronic health condition. It is preventable. It has acute and chronic features. So we want to capture folks' attention early on if there's any kind of risk factors, any kind of signs, and provide prevention services. If that doesn't take, we want to make sure people are screened periodically for this issue, and then that there's treatment, accessible treatment for folks, either through the private system, through private insurance, or publicly. The public system funds about 75% of addiction services in Oregon. So the private sector only funds about 25% of that. And then, as Richard talked about, we want to make sure that there's recovery support services available, housing, supported employment, supported housing, and peer options, so that people can really navigate through those early years of recovery and get ingrained in a recovery culture. That means many different things for people. You'll hear from some people later on today. I'm going to just skip over the recovery paradigm. This provides you with some definitions. We've thought about this a lot. We've come up with a definition of recovery. It mirrors somewhat the national definition from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. It really means that people can achieve full human potential, is what it means. Touching on some of our major initiatives that we are really focused on at the state right now, and I'm on page 7, evidence-based practices, as Richard mentioned. We're very focused on doing what works in the Oregon system. We don't want to do what doesn't work. Wherever I go, pretty much whatever meeting I'm in, if it's with providers or people that are doing recovery supports, they really want to do what works. They don't want to waste time on something that's not going to work. So they themselves have become more savvy in terms of reading research articles, going to training, getting certified, getting special certification to deliver specific curriculum that's evidence-based. We've also been very focused on the Intensive Treatment and Recovery Services Initiative, and this was a new investment from last session. This is outpatient, residential, peer supports, and housing for families who are either at risk of becoming involved in the child welfare system or already involved in that system. And this has really been one of the most rewarding experiences of my career. We are collecting not just data, but we're collecting stories about these people who've been accessing these services. So every week now I read probably 5 stories about people who have gotten into recovery. I'm reading about people who've gotten jobs. They've gotten their jobs back. They've gotten their kids back. They feel like they've got their lives back. There's really nothing fun about being addicted to drugs and alcohol. But when you see some spark happen with a person who achieves recovery and starts having pleasure in their daily lives, just pleasure in walking their dog, that is really something. And those are the kind of stories I'm reading about. But I not only like the stories, I like to see the data. And I have to say that the providers in the counties have really stepped up to the plate to serve this population. We also have an initiative on co-occurring disorders. Many people who have addiction issues also have a co-occurring mental health issue. And so one of the things we did this last year was develop a resource directory for all the programs in Oregon who provide integrated services for co-occurring disorders. We've also done visits to programs who are implementing specific evidence-based practices for that population called the Integrated Dual Disorder Toolkit. It's a SAMHSA toolkit model program. So there's many, many other things that we're doing to specifically address this population and work on this issue at the state level.
What proportion of your clients do you think have co-occurring disorders?
Chair Tomei, for the population who accesses mental health services, probably 70% of them have a co-occurring addiction or substance abuse problem. For people who walk in the door of an addiction program, there's roughly a 20 to 30% prevalence that they also have a mental health issue.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, which comes first?
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, you're asking all the fun questions today. Addiction is a primary disease. So I've heard people say, over the course of my career, I've heard people say that mental health issues come first, but I do not believe that's so, and that's not what I see in the research and the articles that I'm reading. So it could be either or. Sometimes when a person develops addiction, especially if they begin using methamphetamine, methamphetamine is a very strong, dangerous drug. It changes the brain in pretty drastic ways, especially the pleasure center of the brain. And you will definitely become depressed if you begin using methamphetamine. There is no doubt about it. You will probably need antidepressants if you begin using methamphetamine habitually. But addiction is a primary disease. You can develop addiction and not have a mental health issue.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Karen, what about people who become addicted because they're self-medicating because of a mental health issue?
Chair Tomei, Representative Boone, yes, people do self-medicate. There are many paths to addiction, just like there are many paths to recovery. There are also people who end up experiencing a medical issue. They have to have surgery. I talked to one of my colleagues or associates who had brain surgery, and she got addicted to, she got physically dependent to the medication, and that happens as well. She didn't end up trying to score illicit drugs, but people do. There's physical and mental health issues that people will self-medicate.
Okay, thank you, Karen. And as I said, we're going to rush along because we only have an hour left.
Okay, I think I'll just finish up slide 7, and then the rest of it you can read. One of the things that we're pretty proud about in the addictions world is that people, as I mentioned, do want to do what works, and they want to do things in a better way. We have an initiative going right now. It's actually a research project that's funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and we're partnering with the Oregon Health and Science University and the University of Wisconsin. It's called the Network for the Improvement of Addiction Treatment. And what this is really, it's similar to the Transformation Initiative at DHS. It's process improvements to make treatment work better, not only clinically, but business practices. So, for instance, some of the programs have, they want to reduce their no-show rate. They want to reduce the wait list rate. So they've done away with appointments. So instead of a person calling up and making an appointment 2 weeks out, 3 weeks out, they totally do away with appointments and say, you just come on down right now. Come on down anytime you can. And so some counselors don't like that very much because people like their work to be structured and planned, but it has worked better to get people quickly into treatment. And that's just one example.
How many people would be in that program?
Chair Tomei, there are 30 providers participating in this research project right now, and there are two providers, in fact, one you'll hear from later today, Tim Hartnett, who championed this effort early on. So a few years ago, they implemented these process improvement strategies. So he may be able to talk about that as well. But 30 providers are involved in this.
We don't know how many clients. He will know
I could get you that information about how many clients are involved in these providers.
Good.
I can get you that. And as I mentioned earlier, we're proud of the fact that we've expanded recovery homes and we have a lot of Oxford homes in Oregon. Per capita, we have more than any other state in the nation. And I'm always fighting with the Washington director because we're competing. Because these are really, really good programs. They help people to have that support network and stay involved in recovery after treatment. Just a few quick statistics. You may be interested in the top drug of choice in our treatment programs is alcohol at 50%. The second drug of choice is amphetamine, methamphetamine at 18%. So I'm giving you basically the top five drugs that we see in our treatment. Number three is marijuana at 14%, but for youth, it's number one at 58%. Number four is heroin at 10%. And then number five is a tie between cocaine and prescription opiates and sedatives at 2.4%.
Is that in one of our slides, or is that just information?
It is not. It's okay, information I thought later that you might want to have.
Yeah, that's helpful.
And just wrapping it up, those four points I think are really key. You'll hear people talk about those later in the panels. Your next panel is some people who work in the treatment field, and then following that are people who are either in recovery or work in recovery support services.
Any quick questions, Representative?
Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, this is a quick question. Richard mentioned that the estimated number of people needing state services is about 260,000. Is that a number that's increasing, decreasing? Where are we if we look at the overall trend of need in this area?
Chair Tomei, Representative Dimbrough, that number has remained fairly steady based on the population. So each year the NISTA study is done, it pretty much stays around the same percentage. But as the population grows, that number grows. But if you're interested, I can get you a 5-year or a 10-year trend line if you would like that information.
Mm-hmm. That would be great. Thanks.
Okay. And if you get it to our staff, she'll give it to all of us.
Okay.
Any other quick questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned earlier in your presentation on the prevalence, and 1 out of 10 folks are suffering from this. Where are we at nationally? I mean, if we compare.
Chair Tomei and Representative Olson, it is 1 out of 10. That's the national figure that's talked about. I don't know if you saw any of the addiction series on HBO, but people from around the country were really talking about prevalence from a national perspective, where we tend to talk about it at a state level. But 1 in 10 is typically the prevalence that's cited nationally.
Okay, thank you.
I don't have HBO. I'd be very interested in seeing that, if you have a copy of that.
Chair Tomei, I have DVD series. I would be happy to let you borrow those.
Great, and maybe we can share it among people.
Madam Chair, I think that would be a gift.
We'll loan it. Oh. They will loan it to us.
Borrow.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you.
So we have another panel, Tim Harnett, Tanya Pritt, and Keith Urban. And we're going to ask you to take about maybe 15 minutes total with your panel. We've got one more panel after this. We're okay. Yes.
Madam Chair, while we're waiting, I went through this map and I looked at there are 7 counties that don't reflect any, at least evidence-based, practice-based treatment in Oregon, and I'm just wondering if someone can address that, what happens in those counties, where those people go.
So if our panels can't address that, maybe someone, maybe Karen or Richard can get that for us.
Madam Chair, yes. I would suspect Hood River and Sherman County are probably linked with Wasco.
Yeah, we'll find out. Thank you. Thank you for coming, and just introduce yourselves and make your presentation.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Tim Harnett. I'm here today representing the Oregon Prevention, Education, and Recovery Association. We're an organization of 28 treatment, prevention, and staff development organizations that represent the overwhelming majority of publicly funded private sector non-county, if you're still with me, alcohol and drug treatment and prevention services available in the state. Our mission is to significantly reduce alcohol and drug problems and their social and health and behavioral consequences through use of evidence-based practices, partnerships with government and other social service and healthcare providers, and advocacy for effective public policy. I'm also the executive director of CODA, one of Portland's oldest alcohol and drug treatment agencies. I'm grateful for the chance to speak to you today representing both groups. We're also grateful to be with you here with the department talking about the services that they provide. Before I talk about a couple of things that I was asked to talk about, I wanted to just put a little follow-up on some of what Karen Wheeler was describing. I was appreciating, Representative Maurer, your question about cost. And it's my view at this point that alcohol and drug abuse is a root cause or contributing factor to virtually almost every area of public spending. I don't think there's a health or social concern that we all share that alcohol and drug abuse isn't the hydraulics, literally, of spending. If you look at lost worker productivity, 70% of the drug abusing population in Oregon is employed full or part-time. If you look at the issue of crime, 90% of those who are behind bars today either have a diagnosable alcohol or drug problem or were under the influence at the time they committed a crime. If you look at domestic violence, half of the domestic violence cases in Oregon are touched by alcohol and drug abuse. If you look at rising health care costs, literally one in three beds, medical surgical beds, non-intensive care unit beds, are filled by someone who's being treated for an alcohol or drug-related problem. It's literally stunning. Child welfare, conservative estimates put that at about half the caseload are touched by alcohol and drug abuse, either by a parent or a child. Mental health, somewhere between 60 and 80% of those treated with severe and persistent mental illness also have a co-occurring alcohol or drug problem. Traffic fatalities, juvenile delinquency, divorce, learning disabilities, the costs are literally immediate, and then they escalate downstream. So I would just want to tell you emphatically today, you don't buy treatment today, this afternoon your costs go up, and they go up in a variety of areas. And I wouldn't want to let a couple of things that have occurred in the last 10 years to 20 years go by unnoticed. We now literally spend millions of dollars on the environmental cleanup of drug abuse. And who would have thought 25 years ago we would have had to spend that kind of money cleaning up meth labs? That's a big amount of money. Those guys in the white plastic suits don't come cheap. We also now have a new term that's entered our lexicon, narco-terrorism. The Afghans are going to have a bumper poppy crop this year. And all of the proceeds from that, all the heroin that's produced that will likely make its way to Europe, will go on to fuel terrorism. That's a new term, and we use it pretty freely today. So I just wanted to add some punctuation to what Karen was talking about. In the field of addictions today, even though we face very, very tough financial times, we're also, it's a very exciting time to be in this activity. We know that many of the prevention efforts, like those that are undertaken by the Oregon Partnership, are having great effect. We know that organizing community prevention coalitions and implementing evidence-based practices can have a great effect. And I want to let folks know that prevention coalitions that are formed in communities really leverage your dollars. There's a great amount of volunteerism involved in prevention coalitions. And as the money goes away that supports that, so goes that leveraging opportunity. I'd also want you to know, as that we begin to understand more about addictions as a chronic disease, we're getting much better at what I call dosing treatment. we're figuring out who needs what kind of treatment when. And just like when any of us get any other forms of health care, some of it we get in a hospital or in a detox, some of it we get in a residential physical rehab, some of it we get with home health, some of it we get with outpatient treatment, and all of those different patient placements are guided by guidelines. Well, addictions treatment through the state has begun to implement a similar model, the American Society of Addictions Medicine patient placement criteria. It's a big, fancy outfit, and essentially what they've created is guidelines that make sure that the monies that you allocate to treatment are spent wisely so that someone who needs detox gets it. Someone who doesn't need detox gets a lesser level of care. These are good things for you as policymakers to be aware of. I heard Richard Harris describe to you the different elements of treatment, starting with detox, and then we move into residential treatment, then into intensive outpatient and outpatient treatment. And one of the great things that's happened in recent years is we've begun to couple those treatments with community-based or recovery support, and you're going to hear from a group of people who are going to tell you about that just after us. The other thing that I wanted to mention that I thought was important is we're learning a great deal about different subgroups who need treatment. We're learning that different subgroups need different kinds of treatment. And it's just as what you might imagine. It's very straightforward. People who are seniors need a different kind of treatment than kids do. People who may be addicted to different kinds of substances, opiates, methamphetamine, also need different kinds of treatments. We have a growing number of medications as well that are a great adjunct to other kinds of treatments. There are a number of new medicines that we're waiting for FDA approval for. So there's a growing arsenal of resources that we know work, and we're quite excited about being able to move forward with these to help people. Given that we're running short on time, I'll edit myself and stop there.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Keith Urban. I manage chemical dependency services. I left Nicole at home. I manage chemical dependency services for Yamhill County and have done so since 1989. And my contributions today, my thoughts and impressions and beliefs are based not just on the job I have and have had for 20 years, but I've been in the field for 35 in Oregon as a detox. I've had a number of jobs, detox tech and alcohol and drug counselor in several towns in Oregon, eastern central Oregon. I've worked for the state for a couple of years as a regional coordinator, what used to be the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. Don't ask me why. I got hired by a community corrections program that wanted an alcohol and drug guy and was cross-trained as a parole and probation officer and used that great experience every day. So I've seen my field where my heart is from a bunch of different perspectives. And I've listened to the clients who talk about treatment when they're talking to somebody at corrections, because I've worked at corrections. And so that was a really good perspective changer for me. It gave me some good ideas. I don't envy you folks the decisions that you have to make when we have economic tough times. You've got tough jobs all the time, and especially when the money is very, very tight. And it seems kind of hokey probably for folks like us to come to you and say, if you spend money with us, we can save you money tomorrow. If I saw that on TV,
I didn't think it was hokey at all.
If I saw that on TV, I'd turn the channel. The problem we've got in our field is that it's true. The research has been very clear for a lot of years that money spent on substance abuse prevention and treatment saves tax dollars. And I'd like to go through really quickly just some citations and hope that Karen Wheeler did all the explaining about terminology for you folks. 1979-1981, National Institute of Drug Abuse did a study, showed that predatory crimes were one-third to one-half of pre-treatment levels, pre-substance abuse treatment levels, 3 to 5 years after treatment. 1983, federal GAO study, substance abuse treatment was cost-effective. 1986, California public drug abuse treatment study, benefits exceeded cost by a wide margin, quote. 88.
No, I don't think you need to keep reading those. We got that.
Okay,
message.
Do you have that?
Yeah.
Maybe I could just finish that piece by saying that there have been a bunch of reviews of studies and reviews of literature that are just very clear that this is a good investment. Our field is a good investment. And we better be, because I think our jobs, although our technology is improving, what we know about how to treat folks, what we know about the different needs of different populations that come to us for treatment is improving steadily year by year. And it better be, because we see people who start with substance abuse problems earlier in life. The methamphetamine percentage that Karen talked about in Oregon, that's a lot higher in Yamhill County, according to what we're seeing. So we need to be improving, and I think we are. Yamhill County doesn't contract out its public alcohol and drug treatment services. We do it ourselves. And our commissioners tend to be pretty conservative and pretty skeptical about human services and government. They get their jobs, they see them. It takes them about 4 or 5 months to start seeing the public safety aspects of what we do, that 95% of our clients are mandated by the legal system or child welfare, that we're helping divert people from a path of criminality. They see the results, that we're helping families hold together, helping parents, usually moms, regain or retain custody of their children, and they start investing. And Yamhill County is one of those counties where there's county general fund in our budget. They've seen what works there, and they're hard folks to convince. We work so closely, and we think it's important that our system do this with the drug court judges, judges in general, parole and probation offices, child welfare, community resources. None of us is good enough on our own to do this job correctly, and we have to work with each other. And it is amazing and rewarding to see what these other agencies can bring to the table to support and intervene with these folks that we're working with. We have a small transitional residential program in Yamhill County for young moms and their young children. Child welfare is heavily involved in keeping an eye on that with us. It's 15 years old. We've got a great track record of holding families together and getting kids back in the hands of parents who have gotten parent training, got into recovery from substance abuse. Yet the governor's budget would close it. We hope that doesn't happen. We're in the third year of a federal grant. We're one of seven programs in the country that got a SAMHSA grant from the feds to treat methamphetamine addiction in rural settings. And we're continuously evaluated by an independent evaluator. You hear from people that their program walks on water, and ours is good, and so are these other people's programs. I'm just giving you an example. We're able to do some of the things that we all want to do with this federal funding and this grant. Get people into treatment immediately. Do a lot of front-end engagement work. Help get those barriers down to getting them into treatment services instead of going around the barn for weeks. And our preliminary report on outcomes says that 12 months after discharge, that half of those people are abstinent. And we're looking at not only people that completed treatment, but people that broke out of treatment. We're seeing results with what we can do. And we just think it's so very important that treatment be funded well. Finally, part of my job is to decide who to turn away. There are over 1,000, just for an example, parolees and probationers in Yamhill County being supervised by our corrections department at any given time. And at any given time, we've got roughly 300, 325 people in substance abuse treatment in Yamhill County. Well, those 1,000 parolees and probationers that I mentioned are those with substance abuse treatment conditions from court. So they've already been identified as needing treatment. Most of them aren't going to get it. We can save money if we can treat them, but we can't if we don't. And by the way, thanks for the intensive treatment and recovery services effort from the last session. We've got people in our transitional residential program because of this. they're probably going to be keeping their kids or getting their kids back, some of these parents. We've got folks in outpatient treatment. They may not have gotten it before. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, quick question. Are most of the people in the treatment with children, are they more successful than those without? You know, what kind of percentages, or do you know that at this point?
We don't see a clear difference between that. We know that children can be a really powerful motivator. And so we know if you have, and it's usually a mom, but more and more I think we're seeing fathers involved in this, although they may be estranged from the family, and that's a very good change. And so if you see a parent with a child whose custody is at risk, you know that there's a very powerful motivator in almost every case. The ultimate outcome, to me, doesn't seem to be any different from most of the rest of our clients.
I wasn't sure I understood the question. Were you asking whether we have real success reuniting families?
No, it wasn't, Madam Chair. Mostly just wondering if there's any difference in the numbers of people who are in treatment, who were court-mandated for whatever reason, child-related, or criminal justice system put people into treatment, and if there's any difference between success rates in those with or better success rates those with or without children.
Generally, ma'am, what we've seen in the research is that there isn't a difference between the success rates with mandated clients and non-mandated, more voluntary clients. I haven't seen a difference in outcomes. The better we are, the higher outcomes we get on with the child welfare piece. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Hi, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tanya Pritt, and I'm the program director for... Are we all scooting over? You're leaving.
We're going to leave.
Okay.
Excuse us.
There you go.
Go ahead.
All righty. I'm the program director for Family Recovery Nonprofit, and we operate two programs, Milestones Women's Program, Women and Children's Program, and also Yes House Adolescent Treatment Program. We have the full range of services from outpatient to transitional housing for the women's program. I am going to be very brief, partially because we're short on time, and the other reason is I forgot my glasses, so I can't see what I wrote. We admit approximately 60 new families into our women and children's program every year and up to 300 kids. In our outpatient services, there is no waiting. We also are part of that NIATX project, and that is a wonderful objective. Somebody calls for treatment, and they need it right then. And if you tell them they have to wait a day or two, they're probably not going to come in a day or two. So we have our outpatient services open quickly, easily, and we're very accessible. What I want to say before I introduce Daphne Hughley is that I get the pleasure of working with heroes, people of such heroic courage, to be able to set aside and work through the trauma that may be generational, to focus on the work at hand, whether that is becoming reunited with their family, kids with their parents, or women with their own children. I have that pleasure and have had it for 18 years, 22 in the state of Oregon, 18 with my current employer. I want to introduce Daphne by saying this is a woman of such courage and such perseverance to overcome all the odds that she had to do what she's doing today. I've been impressed by her. I think you will be too. So I'd like to introduce Daphne Hughley.
And before we move on, Daphne, we're glad you're here, and we're also glad you're here, Tanya. I have a couple of questions.
Yes.
One, I want to follow up on what Representative Boone asked. Representative Boone and I visited a treatment facility a couple of years ago of women with children. And in glancing through your testimony, it seems that you're talking about that, mm-hmm. that you say family is key. And I think that was the impression that Representative Boone and I came away with was how important it was for these young women who had addiction problems to have their children with them. That gave them more, it seemed to us, I think, if I can speak for both of us, more of a reason for being successful in recovery.
Madam Chair, it just makes sense. If you have a woman leave her children and come to treatment, she's learning skills around her recovery and building that recovery foundation. But her kids are over here in foster care, and so then you reunite them out here, and not a lot of skill building has occurred between mom and child and increasing the parenting skill level. And so I also know, as a mom of four boys, it is a great juggling act to deal with your children, to deal with your job, to deal with your home and your community. And you're constantly juggling and trying to have all that make sense. In treatment, when we can bring everyone together, we can teach that juggling, if you will. And when they leave and step down either to transitional housing or into their own homes, they've had the practice of managing their children's needs, their recovery needs, their job needs, or their school needs. Just makes sense.
And it seems to me, too, as I remember from that experience, that I think it helps these mothers feel not alone, that sometimes I think there is so much shame and guilt that goes with addiction that if you can see other people are sharing this experience, I would think it makes you feel not so isolated.
What's really nice about our program, and we are not unlike, we're not unique, we do what everybody else does, but the age range in our women's program can be as young as 15, pregnant or with a child. And the oldest resident we've had was 65. Now, and obviously they didn't bring their children, but we did get them active in the family portion. having that kind of mentoring that crosses those generations in the peer group is a wonderful gift as well and a strength in the program.
The other question I have, and maybe other people have questions, quick questions, is when you don't have a waiting list, when people don't make appointments, how do you manage that? How do you have enough hours in the day to see people who say, I need to be seeing someone today, this afternoon?
We don't. For years, we have learned to do more with less. And I think that's just our mantra. If we get the phone call, it's come on in. There will be somebody to talk to you.
How do you manage that? How do you manage to have somebody available to talk to them?
I think it's difficult. We just do it. We just do it. We'll have a parent. If you have a parent phone in on the telephone and they're crying and they're upset, you know you're going to be spending a certain amount of time on the phone with that person. Why not have them come in and face-to-face, especially if they're community? I also know people all over the state, so if I get an out-of-area phone call, I can say at a point that makes sense, can you hold for just a second? Let me call one of my colleagues in your part of the state and see if we can't get you seen today. I mean, I think the treatment system really takes that team approach very seriously, and we all work very hard together to make these things happen.
Thank you. Okay. Yes.
Just along the same lines, Chair Tomei, some of us have also formed what we call waiting list groups. We don't think it's the best remedy in the world, but we offer them a couple times a week so that people who are waiting to get into treatment can at least have some contact, some what we call pre-treatment experience, where we can acclimate them to what will happen, acclimate them to what other resources may be available in the community. But I think we're all doing exactly what Tanya said. We're stretched thin, we're punting, we're trying to be as innovative as we can, like calling each other and or having waitlist groups.
Mm-hmm. Great.
But it's a weak solution. It's not much of one.
We're tired.
I can imagine. Daphne, we're so glad you're here. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Daphne Hughley, and I'm from Corvallis, Oregon. And I'm here to share part of my story. I have been clean and sober since January 10th of 2006. And I currently have 3 years sobriety as well as a strong program of recovery. I arrived at Milestones Treatment Center on January 14th of 06 when I was about 2 months pregnant with my now two-year-old son. Child welfare was involved in my life with respect to my other children, who at that time were aged 19, 12, 7, and 5, and 3. I was afraid that I would lose the baby that I was carrying at the time if I didn't seek treatment at that time. I never relapsed since then. My disease almost took my life. It took my family, my children, and my friends, my dignity, and my self-respect. I lost touch with reality in my life. Milestones gave me that opportunity back. I had nowhere else to go. Milestones became my home for the next 11 months, and that was when I gained my sense of self-worth and learned how to live again. They gave me the tools to use as a recovering alcoholic and addict and provided me a safe home to build a foundation of life skills and direction of what I needed to do for my life. As they provided me the direction and counseling I needed at the time of my life, I slowly developed into the woman I wanted to become. I was able to focus on myself and healing within me without negative outside influences, which was pertinent in my life at that time because I didn't have the positive aspects of life, of friends that I needed and family. I learned to love myself again. I started having visits with my children again. I was a mother to my children once again that could provide the love and continuity they need. Milestones provided me with the parenting skills to aid me along and enhance my ability to be the mother I need to be for my children. I don't think I'd be here today if it weren't for Milestones providing me the safe place to live again. I have since gained custody back of my children and have healthy relationships with my family and my friends. I now provide a safe home for my children and I to live. I was able to go back to school, and today I have a career that keeps me busy and responsible. I have graduated nursing school and have a solid foundation to walk on. I can now be of service to others who are still struggling, and I am alive to tell my story. My service doesn't stop here. I fly to Africa March 7th of 2009 to provide care to children who have been orphaned by AIDS and to share my story with families who are afflicted by alcoholism and abuse. I can share my story and continue my journey thanks to Milestones. I could not have done it alone. Thank you.
Congratulations, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Any questions of anyone on this panel? Representative Boone?
No, just a tip. Try to make that a 2-day flight. It's a long haul.
Any other questions? Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks
Thank
the
you.
Whole panel. Now, John Keane, Mike Hermans, Jill Connor, and Carla Ayers. Okay. Anybody start and just introduce yourself.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Mike Hermans. I'm the State Board Chair for Oxford Houses of Oregon, and I'm a drug addict. I was a drug addict for 33 years. I've been clean now for 10 years, 3 months, and 12 days. My story is not unsimilar to the young lady you just heard, so I won't go into that. Oxford Houses are a vital part of the recovery community in Oregon. We provide self-run, self-supporting drug and alcohol-free homes. According to a DePaul University study, a resident who lives in an Oxford house for 18 to 24 months after treatment has about a 6 to 7 times greater chance of staying clean and sober for the rest of his life than a person who merely goes to treatment. Oxford Houses provide us with learning life skills, how to pay our bills. It helps us build a credit history, a rental history, learn the responsibility of running a household, things many of us neglected when we were active in our addiction. If you would refer to page 16 on the handout sheet here, Oxford House, the first Oxford House opened in Oregon in 1988. As you can see, it took us up to 2002, about 14 years to get up to 88 houses. In 2002 is when the state of Oregon funded the contract for our outreach workers through Oregon Recovery Homes. In the past 6 years, we've gone up close to 100 houses. That outreach contract is vital to our continued growth and expansion. All Oxford House people, from myself, the state board chair, on down, are volunteers. We do not get paid for this. I have a regular job. I work 40 hours a week. I probably spend another average 20 hours a week doing Oxford House things. But to open an Oxford House in a community where there are none, which we have done recently in Klamath Falls and Coos Bay, takes a community presence in that month, in that, or it takes a presence in that community for anywhere from 2 to 4 days, for 4 to 6 months, to assess the need and develop those community relations and find a house, interview people to get the whole process started. And we rely on our outreach workers to do that for us. We accompany them when we can, but obviously since a lot of us work, or all of us work, we can't take off our jobs 2 to 4 days a week for 4 to 6 months at a time to help get houses started in these communities that do not have them. Hopefully we have houses coming soon in Polk County and Lincoln County also, which are unserved right now. But the Oxford House system, as you heard earlier, we have the highest per capita rate of Oxford houses in the country. I think that's something we can be proud of. We continue to expand because Oxford House does not have a time limit on the time you can stay. You can live there for the rest of your life as long as you pay your rent, stay clean and sober, and abide by the rules. I myself have lived in one house or another for over 10 years. We expand the number of houses rather than asking people to leave. And the contract that the state of Oregon provides for us for our outreach workers is vital to that expansion. It costs the state approximately 85 cents a day for a resident in an Oxford house, as opposed to, I don't have the figures of what it costs you to incarcerate a person a day, but fairly confident it's higher than that.
Could you tell us a little bit about the process of someone coming into Oxford House? You talk about outreach. So tell me, what would be the process? Would somebody go through residential treatment?
We have great relationships with all the county drug courts, parole and probation, treatment centers in our areas. We even sometimes just get people that are just sick and tired that walk up to the front door and ask for an application. The majority of our referrals come from drug courts, treatment centers, the treatment centers from Department of Corrections, parole and probation.
How many people will live in an Oxford house?
Anywhere between 6 and 15 in each house. As you heard earlier, we currently house about 1,380 people and anywhere from 250 to 300 children on any given day.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that children went to Oxford House.
We have children. We have houses for women with children, and we are seeing an increasing number of houses for men that have custody of their children. Hmm.
Any questions?
No, Madam Chair, just a cost for the occupant. How much do they pay into their
That all depends on the house. Some areas of the state, we do a viability study on a house to how much the rent for the house, how much all the utilities are, everything. Okay. And it's divided equally between the residents. It's usually somewhere between $325 a month. It runs more like $400 in the Portland area. But that provides your housing, all your utilities, some basic house supplies, and stuff. And we do require all the people in our house to, we are self-supporting houses. The great majority of the people in our houses work to pay their rent. We do have people going to school that pay their way with school loans. As long as we see a person doing something to improve their life.
Question, Madam Chair.
Yes, and Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you. And so are the houses actually owned by the state?
The houses, we lease houses like anybody else leases a house.
And they tend to be pre-existing houses, or is new construction happening? Is that
very rarely we will have somebody build a house for us, but great, 99% are pre-existing.
I think it would be really helpful for us. Maybe I saw a couple of things came in. If you could give us some written information about Oxford House. I am very impressed with Oxford House. Colleagues, Oxford House moved into my community, and at first there was a lot of concern, but now they are welcomed by the
I would
the
be glad to. Representative Olson is my guy over here. I would be glad to.
But he's my guy. What's that?
I'm just your bodyguard.
Oh,
I'm
okay.
Not that.
Yeah. I will be happy to put that in the mail to him.
Madam Chair, also,
yes.
In 2007, did we pass some legislation regarding Oxford House?
We did.
Can you refresh my memory?
Go ahead.
I can't. Well, it was, Madam Chair, it was, and Representative Maurer dealt with the issue of the folks being in there on trying to remember
okay.
How we.
It had to do with the model of Oxford House, our manual. We have a manual that we go by, kind of like our Bible, that says that we must immediately expel anybody who drinks or uses. There were some renters' rights groups in Oregon
right.
that had a problem with our eviction process, so we did some bargaining over a period of time and kind of got a little exemption from the landlord-tenant law, not as much as we would have liked, but
right.
Something that still serves our purpose.
No, it's $1,173 a day in state support for 1,300 people. 1380 times 0.85. Which is, I mean,
minimal.
Minimal.
Great.
Thank
you so much. And please do send us some information. I'd really like
I will
to have
do
more.
That.
Great.
Madam Chair, just really quick.
Yes.
What Mike shares, I mean, I've come and visited with him and some of his folks there at their house. And you have a couple of them in Albany.
Seven.
And you walk away impressed with what they're doing.
That's Thank great. You. That's what I've heard. Good.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
And so there are a lot of people here who are not going to speak. So I'd like to know who you are and why you're here. Are you folks from Oxford House or from some of the treatment centers?
My name is Dwayne Worley, and I work for Oregon Recovery Homes. I'm also a proud member of the Southeast Riverview Oxford House where men and children are taught to stay in Oregon.
Great. Is it okay if we do this? I mean,
yeah.
I think so.
My name is Edward Smith. I'm an alumni from Oxford House. So I currently have 5 years clean, and I now work for Oregon Recovery Homes.
Great.
My name is Lydia Lofton, and I'm also an alumni for Oxford and also now a Washington County jail mentor for females.
Great.
I'm Shannon Arnold, and I'm an alumni for Oxford and also a drug court participant.
Terrific.
That's cool.
My name is Jimmy Williams. I'm Morgan Recovery Homes field staff supervisor, and I also am an addict in recovery and an alumni from Oxford Health.
And I'm Wayne Klein, and I am an alumni of Oxford House. I'm executive director of the Recovery Association Project, and I used to have Jimmy's job.
My name is Herbert Bryan. I'm the board chair at the Miracle Explorer. I've been support here with John. I'm also an
Oxford alumni who not only became a president but opened up about 4 houses.
Terrific.
Continued on my journey from there.
Thank you. Great, thank you. Oh, go ahead.
And my name is Ashley Harrison. I'm DHS involved, and I live in an Oxford house for women and children.
Great, we're glad you came. We're glad that all of you came. Wonderful, thank you. So, now we have a couple more people who want to talk to us officially.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carla Ayers, and I'm in long-term recovery, which means I haven't used drugs or alcohol in over 12 years. I'd just like to give you first a brief synopsis of who I used to be and then who I am today. I was a person addicted, obviously. I was addicted to methamphetamine. I went to jail 42 times. I had 3 children who were living in this with me, and I cost my community over $500,000. And how we figured that was by the amount of times I was incarcerated. Family foster care, TANF, court fees, fines, and numerous identity thefts, forgeries, manufacturing and delivering. The blessing that came for me was I was able to go to prison, and I was able to access treatment at that point. Prior to that, I was not able to access treatment. For whatever reason, it wasn't available. So I got to go to prison, and today I get to be a mom. And my motivation...
Coffee Creek, excuse me.
Excuse me?
Coffee Creek?
No, ma'am, I wasn't. I was at CRCI,
Thank
Columbia
you.
River. It was over 12 and a half years ago. Coffee Creek wasn't here yet.
Right.
So having that blessing of going to prison and going to treatment, I was able to get into a transitional housing program. I was able to get a job and access counseling for myself and my 3 children. My whole motivation for getting clean was to be a mom. And today, skipping forward, my life is way more than I ever imagined it could be, more than I ever thought possible. If you had told me back then where my life would be today, I would have told you you were crazy. I am currently getting my master's degree at Portland State. I'm a teacher at the University of Oregon for the Substance Abuse Prevention Program. I'm a member of the Governor's Methamphetamine Task Force, helping to set new legislation and laws for people so that the people who are addicted can get treatment. I sit on the Addiction and Mental Health Recovery Advisory Committee, and I'm a mom. My kids are grown. None of them use drugs and alcohol, which is amazing, absolutely amazing. Addiction really does have a ripple effect, and so does recovery. So if we're able to access the treatment that we need, we can pick up the tools that we need, and then recovery is actually the process of implementing those tools that we've learned. Oftentimes people can't do that because they don't know anybody who's clean or anybody who's doing something different. So that's where the peer-to-peer recovery support services come into place, where other recovering people teach them how to live life on life's terms without the use of drugs and alcohol, no matter what happens. I'm also the regional representative for Faces and Voices of Recovery, which is a nationally known organization that advocates for recovery and tries to reduce the stigma that's attached to it. My life is way more than I ever thought possible. I'm gifted. I'm blessed. I'm blessed to be able to come and share with all of you today, and I give back to my community every day in every way that I can. And that's saving my community a whole lot of money. And that's all I have. Thank you for letting me share.
Oh, thank you for coming, and congratulations. Go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair, representatives. My name is John King. I'm a little bit nervous. I've never been before such a distinguished body. And I'm really blessed and fortunate to be a member of the Miracles Board. And Miracles Club is a club that was established in Northeast Portland about 15 years ago. We've been in 3 different locations because we just never have quit. And it's primarily a volunteer-based club. I mean, it's all volunteer. And we have been benefited by Multnomah County's assistance in order to keep the doors open, but the entire staffing, and it's a club that runs 365 days a year, 7 days a week. We have on average three 12-step meetings there per day at a minimum, and activities on the weekends. And we just had our Valentine's Day dance. It was beautiful. There were mothers and husbands and children and teenagers and the whole club. It's about a 10,000 square foot facility, and people at tables eating and dining and living a different lifestyle than what they used to live. And you know, I can to put a human face on all of this, because we've been talking about a lot of numbers and statistics and them and us. And, you know, to actually see families who I once saw a guy on the corner, you know, who hadn't been bathed in 3 days maybe, and his wife's concerned, but in a meeting, you know, trying to get her recovery together, sitting at a table together, and he's dressed nice, and his kids are sitting there with him, and they're all together again at the Miracles Club. I mean, that's the payoff. You know, that's the beauty of recovery. And that's the thing that keeps Miracles Club going, is that we all are part of each other's lives. Whether your name is Betty Ford or Betty Brown, there's not a one of us here in this room that's lives are not affected by addiction and recovery. And to the extent that we put forward the effort is the results that we get. And I am an example of that, whereas I have been struggling myself within my own recovery. I currently have 2.5 years clean, but I was there just about the day the door swung on Miracles. So aftercare is a really important part of recovery, and we have a saying, keep coming back. And we have another saying, don't quit 1 minute before the miracle, which fits in real good with our club's name. And one of our other sayings is that we are bringing our community together one person at a time. And it's that basic. I mean, there's a million stories in Naked City, right? Who really cares? But one person at a time, and you see that change occur, the effects that it can have on so many people and in our entire state. You know, just to briefly quote a statistic, at $1,600 per day is what the Econ Northwest study cited as the cost to the individual Oregonian for untreated drug addiction and alcohol dependency. And that amounts to $5.9 billion. And it's been said that you can't cut your way into being profitable, but you can't earn your way into being profitable. So that if you are able to get people earning their way through recovery, it is a much better outcome for all of us involved. And in closing, I would say that I feel like a warrior on the front line of a war. I feel all of us in this room are. It's a war that's been waged for some time now. The war on drugs and alcohol abuse is a war that we have been losing, admittedly. But does that mean that you would not give your soldiers bullets? Because we're not doing so good right now. If that were the case, the Union would not have won the war. And when I think about that, you'll forgive me a moment. I think back to, it's Black History Month, okay? Is that we got subsets, right? Well, in our subset, there was a thing called Reconstruction. And in 1870, black men got the right to vote, and we voted. And there was quite a lot of, there was the most elected representatives in any time in history. And shortly thereafter, there were a bunch of laws passed and a lot of things went the wrong way. And people were disenfranchised. And probably 100 years of progress did not occur. Think of where our country could be now in light of current events. I would say that for all of us to fight together and to have the ammunition that we need to defeat this blight upon all of our houses, it is important to continue to fund this good work. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Any quick questions?
I just want to make a comment, if I could, Madam Chair. John, thank you very much for your comments. I have visited Miracles Club once in person, and scores of times through the papers my students have written. I teach at Portland Community College Cascade, and you know, many, many students have chosen to write about the importance of miracles in their lives as a place where they've gone to find community, and it's you should be proud of your attachment to it.
John, tell us how many people are involved with the Miracles Club.
I would say that on average we would see about 150 people a day at a minimum in 12-step recovery meetings. And then on special events, we may see up to 500-600 people, because we do a event. It's regional, actually. We do a picnic where the Seattle Recovery Club comes to Portland. And in fact, we have sent quite a few people north to spread recovery as well in Seattle. And so we may have 600 people at an event and fill up the city parks. And it is a very far-reaching effect. This may prejudice you against me, but I'm actually a car salesman. But I say that to say that the point of contact is where the sale is made. So people, they don't really hear what you say. They see what you do. And our children and the world is watching. And when people see us living lives that are exemplary and they're much different than the lives we led, that is when the sale is made, and that is when the desire to use drugs is taken away, not when you go over and defoliate a bunch of plants.
And how are you funded? How is Miracles Club funded?
We receive a $30,000 funding from Multnomah County, and the rest is all through our fundraising efforts. And currently we are in process of developing a peer service. We have a peer service program and mentoring program that we are developing and expanding upon, and we receive a small $5,000 grant with that. And but the great news about the Miracles Club, and I'm sorry I didn't speak about this earlier, is we're building a four-story building with 40 units of clean and sober housing for families, and a new, brand new club, and we are not going to be leasing it anymore. We're going to be owners, and that is groundbreaking.
How are you funding that?
There's a variety of sources in between Portland Development Commission. We have not per se grants, but tax credit funding, and we have loans to various banks, and God.
What a great investment for Multnomah County. Representative Boone.
Well, I just want to say, if I were in the market, I'd buy a car from this.
Any further questions? We've just about ended on time. Sorry, I'm going to close the meeting and then we can talk. Thank you so much for coming. I really appreciate it. Appreciate all the people who came today. And any last words? Then I will close the House Committee on Human Services.
Thank you all. Thank you for being here.